Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Lowdown. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Paul Bolson, Head of Fitness Advisory Group for UEFA. He's also a consultant with Tigres, according to the jersey which he's adorning in the left-hand corner of my screen. And he's also been working with the Swedish national team where he's been for the last 26 years. Paul, a huge warm welcome to the show.
Thanks, Connor. I've been practicing the delighted all week, but I can't match you on that. But I am actually delighted to be here and looking forward to the interrogation over the next whatever, however long we take. Because I've been listening to your podcast before, and you're a tough interviewer. So really looking forward to the next 45 or 50 minutes, wherever we end up.
Yeah, looking forward to seeing what I can unpack here. But if it's anything to go by our previous two conversations, I think listeners will be in for a joy. But Paul, having listened to numerous episodes below or before, you'll know where I'm going next. Could you please take us through your earliest football memory?
Absolutely. And three really stick out for me. And the first would be visiting my local professional team. So I grew up in the UK, in Torquay, in the southwest of England. And distinctly remember walking up the stand with my grandfather. My father used to be in the St. John Ambulance, so he would volunteer for medical care during the games. And every Saturday or every home game, my grandfather would take me to watch Torquay United. And since then, really, really hooked. And then fond memories of kicking a ball in a garden, as I'm sure a lot of sort of boys did, boys and girls at my age at that time, growing up in the 60s. And I was Geoff Hurst and Bobby Charlton and Martin Peters. I must have scored thousands of goals in that portable goal we had in the garden. And then finally, it was a game at the age of 11. I was captain of the school team, and it was just one game that sticks out. And I was mentioned in the school assembly, not for anything, not for particular talent, but I was my work ethic. I was, and that's something that's I think defined me for the rest of my career. I used to slide tackle, and specifically remember it was a muddy game, and that really, really sticks out. So fond memories of football as a youngster.
Absolutely fantastic. And obviously, it paved the way for an illustrious career in a game, 40 plus years in the performance industry, so to speak. Obviously, the performance sphere was a completely different world when you entered it compared to right now. What was the inspiration on your part to pick that side of the game really to specialise?
It was really a crossroads where I was at a university, actually at Loughborough University. I'd pretty much been accepted to do a degree in civil engineering, and just happened to ask where the football team trained. To which I believe it was a professor or whoever was showing us around said, "Well, why do you want to know where the football team plays?" I said, "Because I play football. I'm very passionate about football. I'd like to think I could give it a go to make the team." And the answer was, if you're studying for civil engineering, you won't have time to play football. And that was a defining moment. At that point, I said, no, then civil engineering is not for me. I immediately did a U-turn then, took a year off from school. I think I had to resit. I took maths, physics, and chemistry in my A levels. I think I resat the maths A level. Got interviewed at Cardiff University. UWIC, I think it was then called, Cardiff Metropolitan University, and literally fell in love with what they were offering in human movement studies at the time. Probably would be more closer to sports science now. And from that, almost the second I entered that campus, I decided that then it was sports science. And I have a lot to thank and a lot of people for my career, but that was a defining moment. That and the 3 subsequent years I spent in Cardiff were absolutely unbelievable.
So it seemed earlier on in your career, curiosity was a force multiplier. Do you think throughout your years in the sport, you've been able to retain that?
Absolutely, 100%. I jump out of bed every day. I'm so privileged to be able to work in a job that I absolutely love, and being curious even during my 3 years in Cardiff. I spent a semester in the United States, actually at Springfield College in Massachusetts, which I then actually ended up going back to do my master's degree. So curiosity is actually what I would say one of the I haven't thought about it before, but certainly something that I would say defines me and being open-minded as well, the two are sort of high up on my list.
And then, of course, I mean, we've spoken before previous times about it, but you mentioned it there, you know, jumping out of bed every morning. There's a lot to be said, of course. I mean, speaking about being such goal orientated, working towards a vision in the future versus early just taking it day by day by itself, looking for the best version of you.
Yeah, and you know, I think doing podcasts like this does make you reflect, and actually we've talked about the reflection piece, and you know, I've given it a lot of thought, and I guess you can, everybody reflects well. I guess, yeah, everybody will reflect, but at different levels and different ways, just like, you know, we all have different personalities, we reflect in different ways, and you know, some people will be structured, do very formal reflection, and very organized. I'm actually probably at the complete other end of the spectrum. It's, you know, it's very abstract, it's very informal, and probably very irregular, but I'm probably constantly reflecting. And if you think about sort of, I'm currently in Mexico, so I'm, you know, every day I'm faced with new cultural challenges. You know, we're always, you know, social media for what it is great, but you know, sometimes there's, you know, new articles being published, new people saying things. So it's this continuous reflection. I guess the more different cultures and environments you're exposed to, in some respects, the easier it is to reflect because you've always got, you know, things to reflect based on or to compare with, etc. So I see reflection as a as huge positive, but you know, I think we can and should reflect on how we reflect. Sounds a bit corny to say that, but I think it's such an important part of, and you've mentioned again as we spoke before about building character. But I, you know, I guess a message would be to not worry if you're not formally reflecting. Like some people will say, an hour every week I dedicate to sitting down and reflecting and making notes. Hey, and for some people that's great. I have a practitioner here in Mexico, and you know, he sends me a weekly report, and it's fantastic. I mean, he's a young practitioner, but some of these so mature in how he's reflecting on different situations. That works for him. Doesn't work for me. How about you, Connor? Let me ask you. Let me throw that one back to you. How do you reflect?
Yeah, it is a good question, and it's something which I've reflected about before. And for me, it's very much, it's akin to the environment in which you're put in. I would say moving back here to North America, as you can tell by the infrequency of the podcast, I would say the last few months or so, it's very much you're put into a washing machine, spinning round and round, and it's only kind of when you get out, have you time for a quick breath, and then you're getting back into it. So I think I've been a lot more intentional about planning my time, a lot more intentional about taking time out during the big holiday periods to have pause for a wider reflection and then get back into the nuts and the bolts. Whereas opposed to before being in previous environments, it was much more of a weekly thing and it was much more of a formal, it was much more kind of an informal thing as well, informal on the day and then formal daily reflector and formal weekly reflection. Over here, it has to be a lot more sit down structured for my side, wider reflection over, I'd say, all three areas really, how I am as a person, how I am as a coach, how I am as a leader. And yes, see where there's synchronicity, see where there could be cause for more reflection and cause for more improvement.
There's something there also interesting about sort of, you know, being in a washing machine. I like that, by the way. It's being around. I'll be using that. But like taking time and interestingly enough, I do a lot of traveling, and I remember distinctly reading that the new trend in traveling when you're on an airplane is not to do anything. So, you know, not to watch a movie, not to get your computer out. And wow, and I realize I'm doing that. I distinctly try not to get my computer out. I may watch one film, especially, I mean, the flight over here, it's a 27-hour journey from door to door from Stockholm to Mexico. But, you know, I do spend a lot of time, you know, not doing anything, but I guess that then you are reflecting, but it's more the informal. I'm not making notes. But it's, and you know, exercising, I guess, is a great time. I'm sure a lot of the listeners will reflect when they exercise. So I'm quite I do like to keep my exercise routines up and running as much as I can, although I'm far from perfect. But finding those moments to relax. And then you also said about turning off. I think that's so important. So I really am going to try this Christmas too. And I'm not very good at it, but I'm going to make a special effort now to sort of turn that turn the telephone off and turn the computer off and really try to spend some time away from the out of the washing machine.
100%. Well, here's another good one for you. I mean, it's interesting when you have such a broad, diverse interest in the game, such as yourself. And I would say I put myself in that bucket too. And obviously, maintaining those relationships with not only stakeholders, but colleagues and friends from all over the world, being in different time zones, obviously, our lens is to be more proactive with stuff. What you don't want to do is create a big game of whack-a-mole for yourself where you're just reacting to the next thing, next thing, next thing. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Completely agree. Completely agree.
And I mean, I suppose to echo that sentiment from us both, I mean, a wide demographic of people that listen to the show, Paul, from anyways, the responses and people reaching out seem to be people that have just taken leadership positions or about to move into leadership positions within different facets of a football club. Now, as a department head yourself, I mean, it's quite a big workflow which you have to kind of get around and cover from the performance of yourself, the performance of staff. You know, key stakeholder relationships, being able to manage up, being able to manage laterally, your own professional development. I mean, for someone starting off, let's say, in terms of optimization of that approach, what have been some key reflection tools which you've used to keep you on track, enabling you to recalibrate and invest energy for maximum impact?
Really good question. I've written down here three words, actually. Being Swedish, I guess we'll have to mention the big man, the famous number 10, Ibrahimovic. And he's well known for saying three things. He had a sort of a speech to his colleagues in Milan, and he talks about sacrifices. So you have to realize that in such a leadership role, you will have to make sacrifices. Belief, you have to believe in yourself. And I think that's a big one. I work with a lot of practitioners who've sort of asked, well, do you think I'm ready to take this role? And talk about, it's fine to put yourself out of the comfort zone, but then there's an area, comfort zone, to panic. And you need to make sure that you're taking yourself out of your comfort zone, yes, but you're not taking yourself so far that you're panicking. And then sacrifices and work hard. There is, everybody knows we tell our players they have to work hard. You're going to have to work hard. And I think probably one of the key things is before you get to that position is actually trying to understand if it's the right thing for you, and not to be sort of attracted by the lights, or it's time for me to I need to be a leader. It may be the right time for you, but it may not be the right time for you, because leadership roles, there's a lot of time spent behind a computer. There's a lot of administrative work. There's a lot of one-on-one conversations with everybody from, people, the young practitioners at the bottom, and as you mentioned, all the way up to the people at the top. And you need resilience. You may come out of a day where it's, every conversation has maybe gone in a direction that you haven't planned it to go, but you need that resilience to keep believing in yourself and know that you can turn things around. So I think it's so important to think through. If you do see yourself as a leader, and I think what I see more and more today is people are being promoted internally, and I'm a great believer in that. So if you have people in the organization who have been with you, it doesn't have to be a long time, but you either you as a leader want to bring them up as a leader, or the board recognize some characteristics of people within their organization that they want to promote to lead. I think that's so important, rather than going through an interview process and it's a risk. You bring anyone into an organization, it's a risk, and we know time and time again that It's you can get it wrong. I mean, we I think it's so important. If now we're changing slightly, but not advice to leaders, but the interview process to bring leaders in, it's so crucial. And I'm a big believer that it should be done by many different people within the organization, from HR to administration to specialist. And actually, we've here in Tigris, we've been interviewing for a couple of key positions. So we have evaluation protocols that overlap but are geared so when the head of or the deputy the assistant operations manager is interviewing a person, they're looking for specific things. And then when we as specialists are interviewing them, we're looking for specific things, but there are areas of that overlap. So a long answer maybe to the question, but it's probably coming back that make sure that if you as a practitioner are applying for a leadership position, you're sure that it's right for you.
Yeah, and I think there's even to make it more of an iterable long-term game, it's been very intentional with scaffolding that journey. And that's something we've spoken about before. You can acquire all the knowledge, all the competencies in the world, but if you don't have that set of mentors, if you don't have that experience to bring you the right way, and we're not even, that's notwithstanding the fact that osmosis plays a huge role in this as well.
So you mentioned mentor there. I actually have a mentor, Malcolm, who I'll mention, and he has an interest in football, but his background is from the city, and I'm terrified every time I have to call it. It's like being called into the headmaster. It's like, Paul, have you done this? Paul, have you done? And he's very, very demanding. But wow, learned so much from him. I mean, I've learned so much from so many people, but it. Not again, not being prepared to maybe go outside of football. Leadership is, I'll also mention a manager, Nigel Pearson, I worked with for many years, and he would say, we become very close friends as well. He would say, hey, I can be a manager of a football club or of a bank, because at the end of the day, it's managing people. It's all about managing people. So again, maybe a message out there, that don't people thinking of going into leadership, and don't be scared to get yourself a mentor. And it may be someone you know, it may be someone you don't know, it may be someone within football, it may be someone outside of football, but obviously there needs to be some common ground there.
Yeah, and then, I mean, speaking of mentors, you're a big one to many, especially nowadays on FIFA. I mean, you're the head of, you're taking the lead on this fitness advisory group. Obviously, taking much more of an integrated approach to fitness coaching from grassroots all the way to the professional game. What was the motivation behind you getting involved in that, Paul?
Just need to correct you slightly. That's UEFA, not FIFA, which is a huge difference. Huge difference. No, I've actually been with UEFA for a long time, and so actually, I think since 2010. And it's not just about me; it's about I think we're 12 of us now. So they deserve probably more. Well, they do deserve more recognition than myself. But it's really. Again, if you think about where we were 15 years ago, which is when all this started, it's a very different place to now. So what we're trying to do is to we started off by providing education for the football coaches. So I don't know whether you're aware, but the so I would say that the education around for a football coach taking a UEFA license sort of 15 years ago, the sort of the whole fitness aspect wasn't that well developed. And of course, there would be in the 55 national associations we responsible for it would have varied from greatly from one to the other. So I definitely saw there that we could there was a need to for us as sort of sports scientists or fitness coaches to really ups or increase their level of knowledge. But what we're delivering on the C license, which is the first license, should be completely different to what we're delivering on the pro license. And that was probably one of the first things we recognize is how we're going to progress. Because as a C level coach or a B level coach, probably some as an A-level coach, you're on your own or maybe with one person helping you. So what you need to know about fitness there is completely different when you then make it to the top as a pro-level coach. And I've seen so many back in the day that, working in clubs and the coaches on his or her UEFA pro license would come in and literally get the fitness coach to do their project for them. And they would just probably buy them a bottle of pop for Christmas and job done. So that was one of the first things that sort of motivated me. How could we work with football coaches to make it easier for ourselves, I guess, to create this understanding? And it wasn't that long ago where I think it's changed now, where sports science really got a bad name. There was this like, oh, sports science, it's all about data. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't know football. And there's some great quotes from some big names that saying sports science is data doesn't control the game. I think and hope it's changed now. And that hopefully is due to not just our job, but the education of coaches. And then after that, again, a big credit to my group and the backing from UEFA, the introduction of the fitness coach diploma. So now you can be accredited as a UEFA fitness coach at the B level and the A level. And that's key. And I'm really, really happy, really motivated, and really pleased about the impact that we have made and will continue to make in that space.
Speaking of impact, I mean, as you said, there's a lot of, I would say, disconnect between the football community and treating football as an isolated subject when you have access to such resources. But going back years ago, I mean, you were part of the infamous Sam Allardyce Bolton team that embraced change, that embraced innovation. I mean, what were some of the key techniques, tools that Big Sam would have used at the time to, of course, take something that was so out there, so abstract, but being able to, I mean, embellish the use of experts and create actionable results for the football team at the time.
There's no question. I mean, Sam is recognized as one of the pioneers. I think probably Sam Allardyce and Sir Alex Ferguson would be two of the bigger names in this country. And I think it was Sam saw a gap where at Bolton he wasn't able to invest in big spend things and in on the player side. But what he was able to do was to bring a team of what he called ologists together. Off the field, it's quoted as saying that I'm going to provide the best support for my players off on and off the field. And what was also really important for him is that we worked together as a team. So it was we also had to be a team who worked together, off the field to support the players on the field. I came into an already, the table was already laid out. So I was brought in after, the basic team had been put together. So many fond memories of my times at Bolton, still in contact with a lot, probably a 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 practitioners from that era that have gone on to make big names for themselves as practitioners. And you think of some of the great players, Okocha, Jokerf, Campo, Jeskelainen, and then even some of the sort of the UK-based players. I mean, it was what a start for my sort of career in British football. To be part of that was really, and I guess it really did. That was a platform for me then to go on and enjoy such a. One of the reasons to enjoy such a successful or long, at least long career in football, but great times, really, really good. And you know what? And fun times. One thing that sticks out is sort of a lot of training grounds. I'm like, I've been a pain in the backside for the security guards because I would never leave. And I remember distinctly with the practitioners there, we used to have a modem, back in the day, the modem that you had to wait for a signal and like we were trying to either send data or get data in or get something. And wow, many, many late nights. I think that's probably if you asked a lot of practitioners back in the time that they, my visits were sort of full on. They got very little sleep, but I like to think they were memorable, and as well as obviously working hard and sort of breaking barriers, we really did enjoy ourselves. They
That's
may disagree if you do happen to get anything on the pockets, but I'd like to think that had a good time.
it's amazing, just obviously not doing just something for the sake of it. Obviously, it's goal orientated. They're playing Premier League football at the time. You have World Cup winners there, Champions League winners, and whatnot. But there's a lot to be said for support staff at the time just embracing such change and innovation, being given the autonomy to be obviously an expert, being able to provide actionable insights.
I mean, the credit has to go to the manager. I mean, there's no question whatsoever that Sam Allardyce deserves all the credit he gets, and whether it's what he does is really been appreciated to the level that it should be. I think it is. I think he obviously still is a big name, and I know he has a podcast which I listen to every now and then, which I find amusing. But the credit's got to go to him, and he did bring in some. His coaching staff and practitioners. It was a really good group, a really good group. And as I said, I'm still in contact with many of them.
Bolton is really a nice segue into multidisciplinary teams. But before we even touch upon that, there's a nice anecdote in preparation for the podcast. I was listening to you on Rob's podcast, Pacey Performance, a few years back, and you had a great story about working for Sweden at the time, being able to juggle two, three different roles on a match day between taking the warm up before a game, running off to the stand to be a performance analyst. Could you take us through that one?
No, it was. I mean, Sweden was a well, is a small country, and been relatively successful in the football world. But actually, it started with the women's team, the women's national team in the early 90s. And I had the double role in order to sort of motivate me being part of the team. I would, even then we were filming games high up with a wide angle. If I remember correctly, the camera had the VHS tape that went into the camera. That's how far we're going back. But it literally, as you say, it would be down taking the warm up, football shoes on, obviously prepare the camera in the place, run up, film the first half, run down for the half time, back up for the second half, and that actually followed all the way through to the with the men's national team until 2017. So it's actually in the World Cup 2018. So actually the last game of 2017, which was one of my strongest memories in football, when we went to San Siro with the Swedish national team in the World Cup qualifying playoffs. So we drew against Italy. I think they hadn't missed a World Cup for 58 years. They hadn't lost in San Siro for 30 games or something. We got a lucky goal at home, so we went there with a 1-0 lead. And even then, we actually, obviously, fond memories. We ended up drawing, which took us to the World Cup, which was just unbelievable. But even then, I was still, down doing the warm up, filming at first half, down, back up again for second half. And it's probably just as well, because those last 10 or 15 minutes were, I mean, I'm sure that if I went back and watched the tape, the camera would have been shaking. But no, it was adapting to the situation, and at the time it worked. Good relationships with the managers, it kept me busy. It meant I didn't sleep a lot, but I can thoroughly enjoy it, and it gave me that exposure to that side of the game, which obviously, I think you mentioned it previously, sort of getting that rounded experience of performance analysis. I've been a coach myself, and my academic background is in exercise physiology, so being able to combine those has been really helpful. And I guess that is. We're not going to have time to go into it, but sort of the generalist versus the specialist fitness coach, and that's a big question and or a big dilemma for many people today is how specialist do you have to be? Should you be? You mentioned they're the multidisciplinary team. I mean, do you want a team of generalists or do you need specialists? We can talk about it, but it's probably more of a discussion for another day. But it's the makeup of the multidisciplinary team today in the modern game at the highest level is so important.
I mean, looking at multidisciplinary teams a bit more, I mean, you did a presentation not long back and you referred to multidisciplinary team as being able to having to manage like a galaxy of experts. And obviously from inference and whatnot, you could tell that years ago this would have been quite a daunting thing to many a coach, many a department lead. But I mean, looking at it nowadays, looking at the broader picture, it could be a team of specialists, team of generalists. How challenging can it be to manage such a team?
I think it's all about getting the right people in, getting the right people. And of course, if you come to a if you're new to a club, you will have to work with the people that you inherit, and that's not as easy as if you've been at a club for a number of years and you've been able to maybe move people on who haven't fitted, haven't had the same vision as yourself, and bring new people in. So yeah, very challenging. But when you and we're very close now here in Mexico of getting that multidisciplinary team working together, and still having some of the practitioners who've been here for a long time. So and then bring in that new people in to work together with them. So wherever there's a challenge, there's an opportunity. And I think that's also really, people can say, oh, a challenge, this is a challenge. This, yeah, but it's also an opportunity. And I've actually just, we had a quick pause there, and I got in I need to go and see the president on Monday. So he's invited me to, and that'll be one of my take-home messages, and really presenting this multidisciplinary team that we're putting together here at the moment. And that's throughout the men's team, the women's team, and the academy. And I'm so happy with the people that we've been able to bring in. Absolutely fantastic people. And of course, we also said that it wasn't the same 10 or 15 years ago, but now, where I am now, and with this multidisciplinary team, I'm really looking forward to sort of doing some great things. And having said that, one of a member of the multidisciplinary team reminded me, I think only yesterday, the day before, because you can get everything right behind the scenes, everything right. You're so happy and you still go out and lose, and their teams can win, and yet it's a complete mess. And that in itself is a challenge. That in itself is a challenge.
Of course. And then, I mean, one thing we've really glossed over throughout this conversation, Paul, has been recruitment. And obviously, you being apparently responsible for the recruitment there of the members that play a role in that multidisciplinary team. It could be at any life cycle, any stage within the football club. What are some of the hard, I would say, character traits that you'd be looking for in terms of recruiting staff?
I think the first thing is that my opinion is one. I think we mentioned it before. My opinion is one of several people, and I'll be completely honest. I've got it wrong before, but thankfully corrected by members of my team and the interviewing process, and they've seen things that I haven't seen. I'm quite optimistic about people. I like to believe that everyone is good. Everybody means what they say, and so I do sometimes need to be supported by other people judging that, but certainly high energy, showing passion, and that balance between, yes, they have to be knowledgeable. And I mentioned there about the evaluation form. My job when I'm interviewing is to do both, to find out more, as much as I can, about them as people, but also then obviously to know where they are in terms of their level of knowledge and experience. And I'm actually working with a practitioner now who was I'm so happy with, but I'm so thankful that I actually didn't want to give him a second interview, and I was because I didn't feel he had that spark and that energy that I was looking for. And another interviewer, my a colleague of mine, convinced me to give him a second chance, and he did much better in the second chance, and it's probably, one of the best appointments I've ever made. So, yeah, the recruitment process is very important, but structured, objective. So we give scores. I'm actually a big fan now of the 4-point score, where to get a 4 you have to be exceptional. To get a 3 you're as expected. To sort of get a 2 you're below expectations, and then to get a 1, to coin a British phrase, you're a car crash. It's you're well below expectations. And we've started to use that here, the 4-point scale, because what it also does is it makes, when I'm interviewing compared to somebody else, we know it's easier to define what a 4 is. It's easier to define what a 3 and a 2 and a 1 is. So it's not as granular maybe as a 10-point scale, but at the end, everybody does get an objective score that gives us at least a starting point then to sort of, when we get around the table to discuss, the candidates, we start with the objective score.
It's amazing how you're able to balance and the objective there with the subjective objective, obviously being able to measure all these tangibles and whatnot, and then obviously brought up there the spark piece. And where it's interesting for me is that spark is kind of akin to an X factor. It's akin to very much like an energy that you require on staff, because obviously we've seen the rise of multidisciplinary teams. There's never been as much resources as frequently provided to players as possible. And one quote you said to me back in November, it always stuck with me since. It's, you train as an individual, you play as a team. So for that communication and trust to be held within your staff member, for that player, within whatever rehab protocol or strength and conditioning building program, I mean, you have to have a lot of faith and trust.
Exactly, and sort of, we haven't touched upon sort of values, but one of my absolute central values is a player-centered approach, and a holistic. So it's not just about the player and the performance; it's about the human and the well-being and everything, both on and off the field. And we may touch upon the sort of 24-hour athlete, I think you mentioned before, but getting that trust of the players and I would like to think, people can question my level of knowledge. There's certainly a lot of people have a lot more knowledge than me, but I would like to be remembered for my being able to foster relationships with players. Not so much here, because here my role is sort of above the team. But to walk into, and I'm actually quite discreet. I don't like to be in places where I don't have a role, so I'm not, in the team dressing room when I don't need to be. But when I'm in the gym, and for the players to come up and players that I barely know, sort of to get a handshake or to get a hug, even a hug from a Mexican player that I barely know. It's in order to be, how do you cope? And I don't know whether we avoid that, but that. You're always giving energy, you're always balancing roles, you're always traveling away from the family. But if you're getting that energy back, that's without a shadow of doubt what keeps me going, is that when you get that back, and it could be a smile, it could be a hug, it could be a kiss on the cheek, it could be just a simple text message. So, if you are in a position to do that to others, I think also it's, we as in our roles, or any practitioner, you could be at the start of your career, but don't underestimate, that genuine handshake, that a little emoji with a kiss. But I've got, one of my youngest practitioners here, he always ends his messages with big hugs. And it's like, the first time I was like a bit taken aback. I mean, this guy's like, he's been in the room for 2 minutes, but you realize it's genuine. And getting that energy back, I guess that would be the answer to your question. Yes, you can. You can travel 27 hours. I can arrive at midnight and have to get up at, sleep 3 hours. I think yesterday I was 17-hour day, but those things that you get back, certainly for me at least, that keeps me going.
And you speak about the player-centered approach there. I mean, is that a result of conscious reflection? Because, I mean, you've dealt with some pretty big personalities and mavericks throughout the years. Have you worked with players from all over the game, from grassroots to pro, both on the male and female side? Or is that always something in your subconscious, something that you've always been doing throughout time?
For me, it's been so obvious. I mean, why, like the warm-up, for example, why am I on the field? I'm on the field to get the best out of the players so they can form to the best of their ability. Everything I do is for them. I don't do anything for myself. And so we, for example, the warm-up in the Swedish national team, it was structured to a point that we had, this part, this part, and this part. But within this part, there was a tremendous amount of freedom for players to. So all the mobility. So with the sort of the running exercise that they would choose their own in twos. They would, and not they didn't have to do the same as their partner. They would, choose their own 2.5 minutes of running mobility exercises. I just set distances. I set intervals, work and rest intervals, and then gave them the freedom and. No, I guess it's something, maybe it's just something that I've found natural, but for me, obvious. And unfortunately, I think Martin Bouchet published a book about egos, and I think you have to leave your own personal ego out of it. It's you have to understand that you're there for the players. And there's nothing better to get once you've got that trust. That there is no better feeling in the world to, and as I say, that's what keeps me going, at least.
As you said to myself, I mean, it pertains to being so obvious, as if it was just common sense. I mean, obviously, you've been working in this game for nigh on 40 plus years. You've seen different iterations, different generations pass through. I mean, what's been the biggest challenge for you as a leader in terms of navigating that communication piece with staff?
I guess it's probably more so now is trying to get an understanding of the younger generation. I mean, like in the older, when I first started, every communication was face to face, orally. I mean, we didn't have WhatsApp or social media. So that I guess that gradually changed now. So a lot of the communications will be a simple WhatsApp message, current players, ex-players. Every now and then I'll find something on my computer and like maybe a photo from back in the day, and I'll just sort of ping it across to them. So I guess that trying to understand, I don't know whether they still call them the I generation now, but these younger generations and seeing them on their phone and even practitioners, I do struggle sometimes, when we're in a meeting and practitioners will in a group meeting that they'll be on the phone. I don't like that. So I was trying to understand the new generation and what social media and the impact it obviously has, but yet still trying to retain that, one-on-one, conversation. So I guess that, and I guess it's the same. I learn a lot from my boys. I mean, my four boys are, they're sort of mid-20s now, so you sort of observe them and you think, wow, they're even older than some of the players you work with, and you look at their habits and I love my kids, they're great kids, and you think, well, actually, yeah, maybe I do need to be a little bit, not if they're on their phone, that's fine, that's the way that they work today, but really enjoy it. And like, coming back, just I guess the smile and that handshake or the hug, that hasn't changed. That was still as strong, as important as back in the 90s as it is today. So again, maybe a take-home message for people: don't be scared to open up and really, I guess opening up is not always that easy. But when you are, and you have to do it at the right time. I mean, you have to. Is it that before a game, is it, some players are really nervous, so obviously you learn to leave them alone. Some people, you'll give them a big hug before they go out, not also then after a game, it's so easy to send a message to friends who win or difficult to you know to hug a player who's after a victory, but hey, it's just as important after a defeat, you know. So I do try to, you know, be conscious of, you know, maybe sending an emoji or you know, maybe trying to sit down and be with players after a defeat, because I think that's also important. So they realize that you are genuinely there for them. You're not just sort of riding on the back of a victory.
Yeah, and that's testament to your character to, again, from what I've inferred from that passage there, Paul, is to value such depth of connection. Because I think that's the proverbial struggle now, isn't it? The quality versus quantity of time spent. And it kind of leads in really nicely to the next point, which is we spoke earlier on about the 24-hour athlete that necessitates really there's going to be a 24-hour staff member there. And as someone who's been there, done it, been at all levels of the game throughout the entire pyramid, I mean, 40 plus years. I promise to be the last time I say that number. But you've had, I mean, you have four good boys there. You've traveled all over the world, managed to retain or maintain an awful lot of those relationships. I mean, what are some of the tools, what are some of the habits that you've ingrained over the years that have proved quite useful to your own longevity in the game?
I actually made a note here that so my third child was born on the 3rd of September, 1998. We actually had a game. I was with the Swedish because it's an international break, so we had a game with Sweden against England at home, I think the game was. So I did manage to get out for the birth. I think I spent maybe the first night with in the hospital. And 26 years later, I think I've been at one of his birthday parties. So I've missed all but one of his birthdays because it's been in an international break. So that's a sacrifice. But I guess what I'm coming to is it's no good making sacrifices consciously or being aware of you're making sacrifices and being away from your family and not accepting it. You have to accept it. You know, you have to accept this is the way it is. It's my choice. If you don't want that, don't do what you're doing. And it kind of brings me on to a point where, you know, I really do not enjoy practitioners who complain, ah, it's too much work, ah, I don't get home. Hey, well, then you're in the wrong job. You know, some, you know, oh, I can't get that report for tomorrow. I don't have enough time. Well, I'm sorry, but you know, I need that report. And I like to think that the team I work with and the team I respond to are prepared to, you know, to maybe sacrifice a night of sleep, to sacrifice, you know, time away from family. That doesn't mean I want all my practitioners to be away from the family. No, I don't. That's not what I'm saying. And that's very different. I do respect and I do try to encourage practitioners to spend time with their family, but it is that balance. But to re-emphasize, I think if you are in that position, you have to make a conscious, or you are away from your family or whatever, you have to accept it, because if you start fighting it, then you're probably in the wrong profession.
And I mean, and again, I think throughout this podcast, it's laden with gold. I think people will be going back listening to this not only once, but two, three times in accordance to whatever they want to take from it, whatever topic they want to stop by the show notes. But I mean, it might sound a bit dull in the grand scheme of things, but Paul, as we bring this to a close, what would be the one bit of key advice you'd like to leave the audience with?
Identify your own set of values. So what defines you? So for me, and we probably touched upon them, but sort of be passionate about. So the take home message is for practitioners to define their own set of values. What works for them? How do they, what ad identifies them? So if they're on the podcast, you know, they can close by saying, right, my set of values are, I think that's really important. And also I learned from a manager, and then appreciate what does it cost to live up to those values, and where is a line drawn? Where, if you're putting yourself in situations where you can't live up to your set of values, is it time to move on? So for me, passion, high energy, resilience, that I think that I would like to think that defines me. Empathy and compassion. I really like to think I treat people with respect, and that could be even today, at an away game, cleaning the changing room, like when my team have played the game. I really like, and with the national team, it could be in the middle of nowhere to sort of Wembley Stadium, to make sure that you show respect. And then, in that case, it would be keep leaving the changing room clean, or, but even if it's like something's missing, the way that you ask for, not instead of, hey, why don't we have this? It's like, excuse me, could you please help us? Humility, I think, is huge. I really like to put that right up then. And like you mentioned, I'll mention it one more time, 40 years in the game, but I have to thank everybody, both on and off the field, that work with me, and that's being humble. It's without them, I could never have done it. I think loyalty is important. People talk about leaving a legend, and that's not a legacy, sorry, and that's not, trying to promote yourself, but it's like, hey, my salary is paid by the club I work for. I have to be loyal to them at all times. I owe everything to to my employees. So being loyal, open-minded, lifelong learning. I never, even I think when I finally sort of bow out from the game, I'll still continue to learn. And I think you're probably learning even more today. You just get, again, a bit of a quote, but you get confused at a higher level. I mean, there's so much information out there. And then, as we touched upon, just really appreciating now the impact of a multidisciplinary team, and really, and it's one thing to say it, but to actually get everybody in that multidisciplinary team pointing in the same direction, with the same goals, with the same vision, helping those players that have to perform on the field. So I think that would be sort of again, another long answer to a short to a question, but define your own set of values that identify you as a practitioner. And then, as one thing you mentioned, is the X factor. I believe it's so important, that something that differentiates yourself from the next person.
Fantastic, Paul. And again, a big thank you from my side for coming on today, not only sharing so gold, but being so, again, value-laden discussion, which I know so many people will take a lot from. So, and again, I'm writing notes like crazy here in my notepad to my right-hand side. So I've taken a lot already. But Paul Balsam, everyone, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you too, Connor. Thank you.